This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host Nellie Bailey. Coming up, Detroit enters the new year an occupied city under the dictatorship of a corporate lawyer. Big capitalists are spending $100 million a week buying up vast sections of urban America. And a new book on the murder of Oscar Grant.
But first, a presidential review board last week unveiled 46 recommendations to limit spying by the National Security Agency. President Obama is not obligated to act on any of these suggestions. Shahid Buttar, executive director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, says he had not expected such wide-ranging proposals from the hand-picked panel.
You know, I was surprised, quite frankly, at the review board's assertiveness. I think the real questions to some extent are whether or not the president will adopt the recommendations and to what extent that will be perceived as the end of a process. I suspect he in fact has already rejected at least one of the big ones, and I suspect he very well may reject many of the others. And even some of the recommendations, while they are generally quite positive, some of them leave a great deal to be desired. Part of the recommendations to end the NSA's practice of bulk collection, tapping the back end of the phone system to collect telephony metadata from all Americans, essentially, that should end. The problem is that the review board recommended that private corporations own it instead, and that's not any better. But the review board did, for instance, recommend that the FISA court, to the extent the secret FISA court process survives the latest or upcoming round of congressional legislation. If the FISA court survives, the review board said that there should be a public advocate to make sure that the judges don't just hear one side of the story. And that's certainly a good thing. And that's a provision that's in several of the congressional bills. I guess I was struck by how much the review board's recommendations tracked many of the pieces of congressional legislation, proposed legislation that would restrain different parts of these NSA abuses.
Of course, the public advocate is appointed by the president, and one can't guarantee how much of an advocate for the public he or she might be.
That's right. And to be fair, you know, even at the same time that the review board's recommendations would curtail some of the worst parts of the domestic surveillance apparatus, they would hardly untangle all of them. And in the recent controversy, the NSA is obviously front and center. But there are lots of federal agencies that spy on the American public. The FBI does it too. Customs and Border Protection, DHS, even the Postal Service, and those dimensions of domestic surveillance would not be addressed at all. One part of the review board's recommendations, on the other hand, I would particularly point to as an encouraging sign, was the recommendation to end national security letters, which was not, as far as I knew, even part of its scope. Right? This was sort of the review board reaching beyond the immediate controversy to address an issue that has long been a problem, but long predating the Snowden leaks, and the fact that the review board was looking at more than the discrete tips of the iceberg and considering the recent history and reaching beyond the NSA to also suggest measures to curtail FBI abuses, I found that in particular very encouraging.
What are national security letters?
NSLs are basically alternatives to subpoenas, and they skirt any judicial review. They're demands by prosecutors for information, often information from a third party. So if, for instance, the FBI wanted to seek the records of an activist, instead of going to the activist, they'd go to the activist's internet service provider or the library, and they would serve an NSL. And here's where it's interesting. The NSLs in most of parts of the country, in one isolated part, the courts have struck them down, this part of them down, they gag the recipient. So they impose criminal penalties should the recipient of the letter even disclose the fact that they got it to, for instance, a reporter or legal counsel or perhaps a member of Congress responsible for legislating in this arena. So it's been an especially nefarious part of the Patriot Act that the review board saw fit to address in its recommendations, even though, again, as I understand it, that wasn't even part of its ambit.
And what is the rationale for leaving in the hands of private telecommunications companies this metadata that is shoveled from the system on everybody's communications?
I think it's a bit elusive, but I think it goes something like this. the founders of our country split the powers of government into different branches and spread them across different levels, right? So there's judicial, legislative, executive, there's federal, state, local. That the rationale for that is to divide power so that it's not all concentrated in one place. I think that's the extent of the idea to give it to the private sector. You know, the private sector has it anyway, so the theory goes. If it holds it rather than the NSA, there's a lesser potential for abuse. And when the NSA wants to zoom in on someone, they can go to a judge, get a discrete records request, submit that to the telecoms, and then get whatever information they need. And I at least applaud the fact that it takes the NSA out of the bulk collection business. Here's the problem. The private sector is no more accountable than the National Security Agency. Government agencies, at least, they are accountable to the public. The private sector is not at all. And if the past is prologue, it's also very porous, which is to say that's a huge mountain of data just waiting for hackers. You know, just, I think it was today or yesterday, 40 million target customers' credit cards were basically, their credit card information was hacked in the last few weeks. But there's nothing to keep hackers from going after private telecom held data in the same sort of way. And should there be abuses, there's really nothing that we, the public, can do to curtail them because private telecoms aren't funded by our tax dollars. They don't answer to any congressional oversight committees. Their powers aren't set by legislation. They're set by boards of directors and people who don't have any formal public accountability. And so in some respects, it could be the panel's recommendations could be the equivalent of leaping from the proverbial frying pan into the fire.
Yes, that rationale seems to elevate the private sector, these giant telecoms, to the level of government agency, independent government agencies.
Well, to be honest, Congress did that 5 years ago when enacting the 2008 FISA Amendments Act, which conferred immunity from lawsuits on telecom companies that facilitated unconstitutional spying, basically giving them sovereign immunity of the same sort that the government had. And there is a profound problem with that. And the collusion of the private sector and the public sector in this arena really speaks, I think, to one of the defining elements, I dare say, of fascism.
And how do you think these 46 recommendations will influence the debate in the Congress?
I hope very much that they influence the debate in Congress a great deal. They track very closely some of the proposed measures of bills, including, for instance, the USA Freedom Act, which the Senate Judiciary Committee is backing under the leadership of Senator Patrick Leahy. And in the House, Republican Jim Sensenbrenner, they are essentially two of the authors of the Patriot Act who have said that the agencies have interpreted their signature piece of legislation to go even further than they intended. And the USA Freedom Act, they engineered to help curtail at least some, again, but not nearly all, of the NSA's domestic surveillance abuses. The review board's recommendations reinforce several of those proposals, particularly the ban on bulk collection, which is a big, big deal. It also tracks provisions in other proposed pieces of legislation that would, for instance, introduce the public advocate in the FISA court process or provide for greater transparency into the aggregate number of people impacted by NSA data requests.
And on the other hand, it might tend to undermine Senator Feinstein's very NSA-friendly legislation.
Absolutely. Yes. No, you're, I could not agree more. Senator Feinstein, the chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, has engineered a bill that she calls the FISA Improvements Act of 2013, FISA being a Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, and it is a total red herring. It is an attempt to insulate the NSA from meaningful accountability, provide the appearance of reform without its substance, and pull the wool over the eyes of the American public. It's particularly egregious because Senator Feinstein represents the state of California, which is absolutely opposed across the state and across its political spectrum to these NSA programs. It's even doubly offensive because the committee that she chairs, the Senate Intel Committee, was born out of an investigation of domestic surveillance abuses 30 years ago. And the creation of the Senate Intelligence Committee was supposed to be a structural reform to keep that set of abuses from happening again, and under her not-so-watchful eye, those abuses have not only recurred, but they have grown to vast proportions never seen before in human history, and I think it's astounding that she, of all people, would propose legislation here, and that the chair of the Intel Committee would be protecting the NSA rather than actually conducting the meaningful oversight that's part of her job.
This committee that made the recommendations was appointed by Obama. How can he reject their suggestions?
Right. That is a million-dollar question, and I think all eyes are on that particular set of events, you know, the president at two different points this year has given glowing speeches, as he is wont to do, about the need to restore constitutional rights in the face of overweening national security, his commitment to transparency, the need for a reasoned debate, and all of it to this point, as far as I can tell, has been talk, and there hasn't been much walking of that talk. The appointment of the review board, one might argue, is a bit of that walking, and the composition of the board, which is not terribly independent, you know, it does have some scholars. You know, my favorite person on the review board is Professor Jeffrey Stone, who's a law professor at the University of Chicago. He was the dean well before then Professor Obama came to the school, so they've taught alongside each other for some time. And Professor Stone has been a very outspoken critic of the abuses in the name of national security that particularly grew under the Bush and now Obama administrations. The fact that the president convened the review board could be interpreted as a step forward in the process of imposing meaningful reform. It could also be interpreted as a red herring, right? The review board has made its recommendations. I think the White House did a commendable act in disclosing its report to the public before anyone, quite frankly, expected to see it. I was very encouraged by that. And it does give me some hope that the White House is preparing the field to follow the review board's lead. That would be a break in the pattern for the president, because he has reauthorized the Patriot Act on no fewer than three occasions. He's always done it on a Friday. He has a serial habit of pledging resistance to national security powers that he ultimately becomes complicit in. The National Defense Authorization Act in late 2011 rings a bell, a bill that he said he would veto and ultimately ended up signing. Or the FISA amendments in 2008 that touched off a lot of these contemporary NSA issues. The president was a senator then, said he would filibuster the bill, only to then sign it. And there are a lot of very profound issues here in terms of the president's unwillingness to walk his own talk. But I do have some hope that as the public clamor around these issues changes, that he senses which way the wind blows, and even if only to preserve his own legacy, hopefully stands on the side of constitutional rights instead of on the side of the military-industrial complex, where he has been for the last 5 years.
That was Shahid Buttar of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee in Washington.
In Detroit, it doesn't much matter these days who the mayor is, since Kevin Orr, the state-appointed emergency financial manager, runs the show. But Orr has announced that he's going to share responsibilities with Mayor Michael Duggan, who was recently elected with support of corporate interests. Abayomi Ezekiwe is a community activist and editor of the Pan-African Newswire. We asked Ezekiwe where the real power resides.
The real power is where it always has been, and that is with the corporations and the banks. And many people believe that this was an arrangement that had been negotiated months before. We have to recall that a tremendous amount of money was put into the Mike Duggan campaign, several million dollars. And there was a lot of controversy surrounding his candidacy. He attempted to get on the ballot. He was thrown off because he had not been a resident long enough in the city of Detroit. And then he ran as a running candidate. That was challenged, but the state election board allowed him to continue. So the whole situation is really a result of the economic crisis, the imposition of an emergency manager. Many people did not even go to the polls in November because they felt the elections were rigged, that they had no faith in the two runoff candidates who participated in the elections. But this is another exposure that Duggan, who is from Livonia and who has worked as a corporate agent for the Detroit Medical Center, he privatized it and prevented the Michigan Nurses Association from organizing there. This is just another method for the further consolidation of corporate power in Detroit.
Well, electoral politics isn't the only kind of politics. How are things going at the grassroots level in terms of resistance?
The resistance is still building to this whole process. They have gotten an okay to go to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals in an effort to overturn Judge Rowe's decision that the city of Detroit was, in fact, eligible for bankruptcy. Now, he said they were eligible for bankruptcy despite the fact that he acknowledged, even in his own ruling, that the Orr regime did not negotiate in good faith, but he says it was impossible and impractical to negotiate in good faith because there were too many creditors. So this is the type of logic that's being utilized in the federal bankruptcy court. but it is being challenged. And I think this trial further exposes the role of the emergency manager and the governor in paying off the banks and reinforcing the underdevelopment and the overall economic strangulation on the citizens of the city of Detroit.
But what's happening in the streets? How are people mobilizing in Detroit to show their feelings about what the emergency financial dictator is doing?
Well, people are doing different things. We were out in front of the bankruptcy court on the 17th at the beginning of the trial on the interest rate swaps that's opposing it. We have an attorney that's involved in the trial on a very, very intense level, questioning Kenneth Buckfire and others. There's also efforts underway by AFSCME, the major municipal union in the city of Detroit. They're spearheading the appeal of this unjust decision. The pension board is also challenging the Barclays swap deal because they realize that if they don't challenge it, it's going to be even more difficulties for them. What they want to do is bypass directly the pension boards and the union officials and the elected officials and go right to that $5 to $6 billion that's there so they can readjust it, restructure it. In other words, they want to take the money and give it to their friends to gamble off on Wall Street. That is the real bottom line. And this sets a dangerous precedent for the rest of the country because in Judge Rose's ruling, he said that the pensions, despite the fact that they're guaranteed by the state constitution, can be diminished by the bankruptcy court. So they're hoping, i.e. the bond insurers and the bankers and the corporations, they're hoping that this will set a legal precedent so they can go after other pension funds around the United States. And we're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars, if not several trillion dollars, that are tied up in these pension funds. So, yes, people are mobilizing here in Detroit. They are organizing. We have a media offensive that's going on. We're trying to do as much education and analysis as possible. But we need the help of others around the United States.
What do you and the people around you think the ultimate corporate goal for Detroit is beyond grabbing pension funds for use in speculative markets? What do you think Detroit would look like under a corporate development plan?
Well, we already see indications of it right now. We have senior citizens and low-income people being forced out of apartment buildings in downtown Detroit. We have Dan Gilbert, who's over Quicken Loans, being given 19 to 20 buildings in downtown Detroit, buildings that were in foreclosure and receivership. We see the total neglect of the neighborhoods, the public transportation system, even along Woodward Avenue, which is the main thoroughfare in the city of Detroit, which they're claiming now is being revitalized. Taking a bus is a very horrible experience. The streets are still in tremendous ill repair. The streetlights, they've repaired a few of them, but most streetlights are still out around the city. The morale of the municipal workforce is at an all-time low, and we have all types of deals that are being cut. Millions of dollars are being handed over to consultants for restructuring, and the only restructuring that we see is taking money, public money, and turning it over to private interests. But in terms of the overall conditions of the people in the city of Detroit, it is not improving. Their objective is to bust the unions, to seize public assets and sell them off, like Bella Detroit Institute of Arts, which they just finished an assessment of, and the Detroit Water and Sewage Department, and other entities that are the public property of the residents of the city of Detroit are up for grabs in this whole process. If they are able to get this Barclays deal through for $350 million to pay off UBS and Bank of America, it means that 20% of the tax revenue of the city of Detroit will have a lien placed on it by Barclays Bank. It also means that if there's a default in the whole repayment scheme, they can, of course, seize or place a lien on public assets such as Belle Isle or the Detroit Institute of Arts or the Detroit Water and Sewage Department, perhaps the Detroit Zoo. So this is a very dangerous deal, and that's why we've focused a lot of attention on it because it's a test in regard to how the whole fairness doctrine is going to be implemented in the bankruptcy process.
That was Abiyomi Azikiwe. Kevin Orr, the state-appointed boss of Detroit, is a former lawyer for Jones Day, the huge corporate law firm that is now acting as Detroit's legal counsel. Jones Day also represents some of the city's biggest bank creditors and is the lawyer for a sports company that owes Detroit lots of money. It seems that everywhere you look, Jones Day is there. The firm has clients on all sides of the issue. When a federal judge ruled that retiree pensions deserve no more protection than anybody else in Detroit, we asked People's Lawyer Tom Stevens if the ruling is a dangerous precedent.
Oh, God, yeah. And indeed, that same date, the state of Illinois passed legislation for basically pension theft legislation. God knows what's next. You know, here in Michigan, Jones Day has been pursuing Detroit as a business opportunity since early 2012. They say they put 1,000 hours into it before they even got the contract. You know, it's been throughout the last several years, the thinking, such as it is, or the objective, the opportunism in the corporate right has been the guy who saves Detroit can write his own ticket, right? You know, because it's such a mess. And from our perspective, you know, that's, I think, what that really is. Well, capital is facing a catastrophe that's created in Detroit and everywhere else. What are they going to do about it? Well, you know, where better than Detroit to try to work out the plan, the model. And, you know, you've written about it very well, and others have written about it very well. This is clearly precedent for every place else. You know, there's the problems are so intense. The mess that they created is so great. And people just don't care about the victims. I mean, the dominant narrative says it's all our fault anyway. It's all those, you know, useless, lazy Detroiters who voted for corrupt Mayor Kilpatrick and so forth and so on. It doesn't have anything to do with what the system has done in this community, with its deindustrialization and the white flight and the capital flight and all the rest of it. We don't even talk about that stuff.
So Jones Day, the corporate law firm from which Orr comes, is trying to make a reputation for itself as the firm that can bring down pension plans, the go-to firm for that kind of purpose.
Bring down pension plans and subsidize billionaire sports developments in a bankrupt city and negotiate and make every kind of deal that you need to make or want to make as long as you just pay them $1,000 an hour, they'll do whatever needs to be done.
Well, if the pension plans can be tapped, then wrecking a city becomes an even more profitable business.
It certainly is a huge subsidy for that activity. There's no doubt about it. I mean, you know, the thing about the pension plans that they never acknowledge is that the Detroit pension plans, there's two of them, you know, one for the uniformed police and fire services and one for the other city employees, are actually very well funded. You know, that's not the problem. The problem is that they're being funded by the city of Detroit, which is in its own, you know, intense financial crisis. It's breaking the city of Detroit to do all the things the city of Detroit has to do, including pay back Wall Street investors. And so they focus on the pensions as if, oh, my God, you know, that's a problem. And as if that's the problem. And then they offer their solution, which is, of course, for them very profitable and involves, not coincidentally, you know, not changing the existing distribution of power or giving anybody any kind of a better deal that would allow us to have a decent quality of life.
So in other words, what you're saying is if you are a city or a state employee somewhere and your pension plan is not in trouble, it is well funded, but your city or state is having financial problems, you and your future, your retirement is still in jeopardy.
Exactly. I mean, I think it was Richard Wolff who said it very well recently on one of the alternative TV networks. He said, look, this is sending a message to every employee in the country. If you have a contract with your employer where you both agree that instead of a raise or instead of a couple extra days off or some health care benefits or whatever, part of your compensation is going to be a pension, if you've ever agreed to that, or if you do it now, forget about it. Anytime the employer runs into some economic difficulties, they could decide, well, you know, I'm not going to do that. So contracts are good for some. The market is good for some. Contracts are not so good, and the market is not so good for others. It's all about power. And, you know, the level of dishonesty, the level of greed, the level of injustice, and the intensity of the class conflict that is leading to this result is just playing itself out in Detroit right now in ways that are frankly shocking to everybody.
So if this makes conventional pensions inherently politically unstable, then that would drive people towards 401ks, wouldn't it?
Oh, that's their whole objective, yeah. I mean, I think canceling the existing pensions is just gravy for them. Even the federal appellate courts may or may not let them do that, especially in light of the fact in Michigan we have explicit, strong constitutional protection for public pensions. But what they really want to do, and I think what they probably will be able to do, is eliminate traditional defined benefit pension plans in the public sector where the employer agrees to put aside the money and where the employer bears the risk if the investments the money is invested in don't pay out. And the employer says to the employee, yes, you will have a pension. I'll take care of it. And do, as you say, instead the 401k, the defined contribution plan, where the risk of failure is on the employee. And then in our context, of course, where working Americans can't really afford to put aside the kind of money that's necessary for retirement. So as a practical matter, what the unbiased studies show here, and I've read a whole bunch of them, is that this defined contribution plan is no retirement at all. You know, traditionally, what was decided, what was suggested, was that retirement should be a three-legged stool, right? Social Security, some of your own savings, plus a pension plan. Well, given how little money people are making, it's down to Social Security, and they're coming after that, too.
So we're looking towards a total insecurity state in our corporate future.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, both austerity on the economic level and the evisceration of democracy in the political realm. They go hand in hand. It's easiest to pick out an African-American community that's in a state that's mostly white and it's moving to the right and it's gerrymandered and all the rest of it. And, you know, they're trying out the model there and then see how far they can stretch it somewhere else. Get it to Chicago, get it to Pittsburgh, get it to Washington, D.C., wherever.
The conversation is always all about what Detroit owes, but never about the people who owe Detroit, like the guy who owns the Tigers.
That's absolutely right. I mean, Mike Ilitch, the multi-billionaire pizza mogul, owner of the Tigers and the Detroit Red Wings. And in fairness, a guy who's been investing in Detroit for a long time before it was hip and cool, a long time before we ever heard of Dan Gilbert. He wants the city's approval now for a new sweetheart deal to build a hockey rink. Public land, public money, in a bankrupt city. And there's been quite a bit of national publicity about this. It's like, what, are you crazy? All the studies show that building a professional sports arena with public money is not a viable way to go if you're talking about community economic development, quality of life for the people in the community. It just doesn't work. And here in Detroit, we've already had one baseball stadium built for Ilitch and one football stadium right across the street built for the Detroit Lions and the Ford family with public money. And the whole time, all this catastrophe was going down. So now while they're in bankruptcy court, they're wanting some more money for the Red Wings to build another stadium just up the street from those two. And at the same time as Jones Day is supposedly in there negotiating a different deal with the slots counterparties, including their own client, Bank of America, in the bankruptcy, Jones Day has now been also called in to negotiate Ilitch's back taxes and unpaid licensing fees that he owes the city based on the Joe Louis Arena, the current home of the Red Wings. It's just totally crazy. I mean, Jones Day has taken over the city. They're doing whatever they want as government. They're making whatever deals they want with whoever they can for their own benefit and for those extraordinarily wealthy and privileged individuals and powerful people. And, you know, the idea that any of this could possibly help the city and the residents of a city, you know, a city of still 700,000 people, about half of them around poverty or above poverty, everybody's struggling. It's ludicrous. It's totally ridiculous. I mean, the idea that any of this has any public benefit or any legitimate rationale for quality of life for the people who live here, it's becoming daily more and more obvious that this is just a bunch of insiders. I mean, I was in the bankruptcy court the other day for about an hour. It just drives you absolutely nuts. Whole rooms full of guys and a few women in suits, all of them getting paid to argue about, you know, who's going to get some money here. The government of the city, the people of the city, have no power to make any decisions about how our city is going to go, how it's going to function. the decisions that are being made that affect our lives, forget it. You guys are not welcome.
That was People's Lawyer Tom Stevens.
For more than a year, a small group of corporations has been scouring America's cities, buying up foreclosed family homes and turning them into rental properties on an unprecedented scale. Journalist Laura Gottsdiener has been on top of the story. She reports that the land-grabbing companies have been spending at the fantastic rate of $100 million a week, buying up thousands of properties at a time. Gottsdiener says the corporations are behaving like land pirates.
Yeah, making out like bandits is right. What we're talking about is really a housing crisis 2.0. So we're seeing pretty much the cousin companies or the sister companies of all the big banks, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, JP Morgan, Deutsche Bank, all of the big banks that crashed our economy in the first place. Now what they're doing, the cousin companies of these banks, essentially are executing a massive land grab. Private equity firms and hedge funds buying up cheap foreclosed properties, cheap foreclosed homes that families used to live in all over the country. And there's really no other way to think about it except that it is a land grab. And once again, Wall Street is controlling wide swaths of American life.
And one of the most prominent cousin companies that you speak of is Blackstone, which is buying up huge swaths of property in cities.
Exactly. So the Blackstone Group is the biggest culprit in this game. It's not the only one. There's American Homes for Rent. There's Colony Capital. There's a few others. But the Blackstone Group is really, it's extraordinary how much they've bought up in just the last year and a half. So from, you know, 2 years ago, they really didn't own any single-family homes. Today, they're the largest owner of single-family homes in the country. And this empire is the biggest one that's ever been amassed throughout U.S. history. So they own approximately 40,000 homes in, you know, about 14 cities across the country.
And in one day, you write, they bought 14,000 houses in Atlanta alone.
Yeah, it's staggering. So the thing that's really important to understand is that it's not like Blackstone Group has the same capacities as any individual family to buy up a house. No, this is a multi-billion dollar company that has enjoyed, you know, a $3.6 billion credit line just to buy up these houses. And what's worse is they don't even need to necessarily go to the auctions or buy individual homes like ordinary people do. So they pretty much buy these houses in bulk from the banks in the same way that an ordinary family might go to Costco and stock up on toilet paper.
And we're talking about billions of dollars worth of homes and transactions that are carried out in cash. With this kind of money power, they actually can enter a city and set the terms and shape the market for housing.
Exactly. So what we're seeing is, you know, and it's really amazing to me that we don't talk about it more. When we talk about home prices rising, what we're really talking about is Blackstone and these other companies going into markets, buying up so many homes so quickly that they push the prices of the houses up in that market, sometimes up to, you know, 20 or even 30% over the course of a year. And that's a shock to local markets. And what it means down the line is not only are they controlling the home prices in these cities, they're pushing them up, but down the line, it's very likely that they'll be able to price fix the rental rates as well in these cities. You know, and I was actually just on a radio show down in Florida, and a real estate agent called in and said, listen, there's some areas of our city where Blackstone and these other companies own so many of the houses that they essentially just decide whatever the rental rate is going to be in our city. So they've already started to, you know, he shied away from using the word price fix, but seems to me that it's a classic example of price fixing, cornering a market and then setting the rate.
Yes, many people anticipated that as one fallout of the housing debacle, at least the price of housing and rentals for housing might become more affordable. But with the intervention of big capital in such a big way, that's not happening.
Not happening at all. You know, just a few weeks ago, the president of HUD went on the press conference a few Mondays ago and said that we're in the worst rental affordability crisis as this country has ever seen. Not in the last 5 years, not since the Great Depression, but ever in the history of this country, we are facing the worst rental affordability crisis. Now, 7 years after the housing market collapsed. So if you think about families losing such a staggering amount of wealth, communities losing such a staggering amount of wealth, and now we're having rental affordability crises, it's getting really incredibly difficult and precarious just to simply live in this country. And that's why, you know, not only do I do these investigations, but I try to be quite clear that underlying problems like the Blackstone Group is a broader problem about how we think about housing and how we define housing in this country. And until we move closer to a human rights framework for housing, until we say housing is a human right, it's a human need, we need to revamp our housing market such that everybody is able to have a place to live, we're just going to see that it's going to get harder and harder and more expensive to live in this country.
It's interesting that you call these cousin companies, and they seem to be acting in concert with their big cousins, the ones who caused the collapse of the housing market back in 2007, 2008, that they are now performing the job of shoring up the assets of those same companies.
Exactly. So, you know, everyone's really working together on this one. It's clear and it's important to say that Blackstone is not a bank, a Wall Street bank, in the way that J.P. Morgan Chase is a Wall Street bank. But when you start to actually trace the money and see who profits from this type of shenanigans, you see that it is all the Wall Street banks and that these two types of entities really just work together. So, for example, you know, Blackstone has partnered with Deutsche Bank and with J.P. Morgan Chase to develop a security called a rental-backed security, which means that when we as ordinary people rent from a Blackstone home, the company is going to bundle our rental payments and sell them off as a security to investors all around the world. And when they do that, it won't only benefit Blackstone, it will also make money for Deutsche Bank and make money for J.P. Morgan Chase, and it'll make money for all of Blackstone's institutional owners. And you guessed it, yes, those are all of the major banks that crashed the economy in the first place.
This gives new meaning to the term cartel.
I think that it's very clear that we're living in a corporate cartel environment, in the sense that, you know, we are looking at a scenario in which the assets in this country, and I hate to use the word assets because I think we really need to start redefining what homes mean and how they're valued, but if we live in an environment in which they're defined as assets, then we need to see that the majority of these assets and the majority of the wealth and the majority, therefore, of the legislative control is all tied up in Wall Street. And so whether it's J.P. Morgan Chase or it's Blackstone, you can see that they're working together and they're both working against the interests of the American public.
This massive capital intervention in the housing market is so large, only a sovereign government could match it. Doesn't that seem to cry out for a federal counter-intervention?
Yeah, I think when you start to talk about the issue of the federal government, you have only seen very disappointing interventions from the Obama administration since the beginning of this crisis. And, you know, to be clear, I think that we need more government action, not less. So I'm not trying to slam the government, but the lack of intervention on behalf of ordinary Americans dealing with the housing crisis was staggering. The Obama administration, every single program that the administration unveiled that was supposed to help ordinary Americans seemingly was incapable of dispersing its funds. For example, the HAMP program, the Home Affordable Modification Program, you couldn't even dispense the funds that had been allocated to help ordinary homeowners. We didn't see any type of problem when the Obama administration bailed out the banks. The banks had no problem receiving those trillions of dollars overnight from the federal government. And now today what we're seeing once again is the Obama administration actually celebrating the housing recovery without scrutinizing who it's a recovery for. And if you start to run the numbers as I have and as other economists have, you know, and other journalists have, you see that this is not a recovery from ordinary Americans. This is not a recovery for the 99%. This is only a recovery for Wall Street. And it certainly calls for increased federal intervention to stop such a land grab.
Well, maybe the bankers' housing recovery is what the Obama administration is celebrating. It left, as you mentioned, billions of dollars sitting in federal coffers in the HAMP program instead of helping out homeowners. And we have to note that in 2007, 2008, of the remaining presidential candidates, Obama was the only one who refused to endorse even a voluntary moratorium on foreclosures.
Yeah, and I think that you're spot on that. And it's important to say that, you know, in polls in 2009, 2010, the vast majority of ordinary Americans supported a moratorium. And since the Obama administration has been completely unwilling to even entertain serious federal intervention, that's why we really need to start moving towards a people's moratorium to stop evictions, and we need to start moving towards serious community organizing to get players like the Blackstone Group out of our neighborhoods. And so there are dozens, hundreds of community organizations and grassroots movements that are enacting that type of people's moratorium on the ground. They're mobilizing communities, they're stopping evictions, they're taking over bank-owned houses. You know, I've documented a lot of this work, incredible organizing in Chicago, in Atlanta, in LA, in San Francisco. It's starting up in New York, even in parts of North Carolina where all the big banks are based. And so that's the type of work that if we are serious about moving towards a more sane housing policy in this country, we really need to increase and we really need to be supporting.
Well, it looks like housing policy as a political issue is almost a blank slate because the federal government hasn't had a housing policy for a very long time, unless, of course, laissez-faire is the policy.
Yeah, I think the only, you know, serious housing policy discussion that we've had recently is how to privatize Fannie and Freddie. And again, I think that privatizing various aspects of a market that really caters to people's basic human needs is exactly the wrong direction we need to be going. For me, I think the most insidious and scary aspect of this is that the Blackstone Group has unveiled a new type of risky security that's further financializing, further commodifying housing. And so what it did just a few weeks ago was release the first AAA-rated rental-backed security in U.S. history. Now, what does that mean? Because I know it was a lot of jargon. What this means is if somebody lives in a Blackstone-owned home, their rental payment is going to be bundled with the rental payments of thousands of other renters. And that is going to go into a bond that is sold off to investors all around the world. And, you know, what's really important to understand this is who those investors are going to be. And because this has received a AAA rating, but because it's not going to actually yield an incredible return, those investors aren't going to be the Goldman Sachs of the world. They're going to be pension funds. They're going to be, you know, teachers' retirement funds. They're going to be municipal governments. And so in the future, if we're concerned about the health of our local government, if we're concerned about the health of our teachers' pensions, we need to say they shouldn't be investing in these risky products. And these risky products shouldn't be on the market at all. They should be utterly illegal, and they definitely did not deserve a AAA rating. So it's important to understand the way that Wall Street is further financializing and further commodifying housing, because this is going to have huge repercussions in the broader economy. Whether or not you live in a Blackstone-owned home, whether or not you're a renter, a homeowner, or you live in public housing, this will impact the health and the long-term resilience of the community in which you live.
So you're saying that these rental securities, like the mortgage securities, if they go sour, it would have vast ramifications throughout the economy and the society.
Exactly. I mean, this product is very similar to mortgage-backed securities. I mean, the name sounds similar, the construction similar. Every investor that I spoke to for the article and for my research pretty much said it's the exact same product. I think it's important to say right now, rental-backed securities have nowhere near the share of the economy that mortgage-backed securities have right now. So it's a much bigger product. It's much more spread. But financial institutions are estimating that rental-backed security and this institutional investor bet on housing is going to swell to a $100 billion industry, $100 billion. Again, it's important to say this has never existed before in human history or in U.S. history. This is entirely untested. And just 7 years out from one of the greatest housing crises that we've had in this country, seems like a terrible time to make a new short-term profit, risky bet on the housing market.
So it seems that big capital is going to follow up on its 2008 debacle with another kind of debacle from a very similar recipe.
Exactly, and once again, we'll be left holding the bell.
Journalist Laura Goetzdiener is author of the book A Dream Foreclosed, Black America and the Fight for a Place to Call Home.
Los Angeles-based journalist Thady Siswe Chimurenga has a new book coming out in January. It's titled, No Doubt, The Murders of Oscar Grant. Grant was the young man shot dead in Oakland, California, by a BART mass transit police officer on New Year's night, 2009. We asked Chimurenga why she uses the plural murders in the title, meaning more than one murder of the victim.
Because in this book, I take a look at the ways that the media and the court system murdered Oscar Grant. I mean, the book is my recollections and my analysis of the trial of the murderer of Oscar Grant, Johannes Meserle, but it's also looking at the phenomenon of police murder in general through the lens of this one case. There are similarities between Oscar Grant's murder and the murder of many folks across the country by not only police but by white vigilantes such as George Zimmerman. So in addition to the physical murder of a person, they're also murdered by media and by courts. And usually we call that, when it's in the media, character assassination, but I consciously chose the word murder because the judge in this trial made it a point to criticize people who were calling for Johannes Meserle to be convicted of murder. He was saying, well, you know, that's for a jury to decide, and the jury has already decided it's involuntary manslaughter. I consider that to be an illegitimate verdict.
And how was the media complicit in this secondary murder?
Well, one of the ways that media is complicit is by, under the guise of publishing facts, but there's no context, there's no probing questions. So to a certain extent, they're doing their job. They're not lying. They're publishing facts. But if you don't have context around a particular fact, if there's no probing questions regarding certain facts, that's one issue of how murder is committed, in addition to the secondary issue of commentary that is utilized throughout new media and old media in terms of letters to the editor, in terms of commenting on social media sites, social media groupings, YouTube, etc. Referring to the first issue in terms of lack of context, when you publish a person's background history, number one, that's always suspect. What is the reasoning behind publishing a person's background history? Number two, in Oscar Grant's specific example, Johannes Meserle's defense team published the contents of their motion for bail. Within that motion for bail, they utilized Oscar Grant's autopsy results, which mentioned the presence of a narcotic drug in his system. We come to find out over a year later that the presence of that drug in his system is because the hospital administered it to Oscar Grant. But more than a year has passed where Oscar Grant's name has been dragged through the mud, stating that he was on drugs and high at the time he was killed, and therefore that's the reason he created so much trouble, quote-unquote, with Johannes Meserle having to tase him and subsequently pulling his gun by mistake.
And, of course, we saw the same kind of conduct by the defense in the Trayvon Martin trial.
Yes. For me personally, I have never smoked marijuana. But, of course, I know people who have. So I can't tell you firsthand experience what it's like to smoke marijuana. But, you know, everybody tells me, you know, you get sleepy, you want to eat. And I'm looking at the Trayvon Martin trial, and I'm hearing people talking about marijuana may have made Trayvon Martin violent. Really? So the first time in the history of marijuana usage just happens to be the time where this young black man is being put on trial for his own murder. Really? And these are the questions that are raised in media by media commentators, so-called journalists. So that's what we mean when we say murder by the media, not character assassination, murder.
Well, in the sense that you're talking about, not just Oscar Grant and Trayvon Martin, but countless others and maybe a whole class of young black men are murdered before they're actually shot down by this kind of defamation.
Oh, most definitely. I think that the murder by media before the actual black or brown body is murdered, this is what sets it up. This is what makes it easier to actually pull those triggers.
Oscar Grant was killed on New Year's Day 2009. Others in Oakland have been killed since then. And, of course, hundreds are similarly executed across the United States every year. What makes the Oscar Grant murder and trial and its aftermath unique or stand out so that you would write a book about it?
Well, primarily, I was able to witness the trial. That's one of the reasons why I'm writing on it, as opposed to writing on the murder trial of George Zimmerman for Trayvon Martin's death based off of what happened on CNN. I was in the courtroom and I saw what was going on. But also, this case is unique for several reasons. Number one, this murder was captured on video by cell phones and digital cameras and shown all over the world. That's number one. Number two, it is the first time that a police officer in the state of California went on trial for an on-duty shooting. Number three is the first time that a police officer in the state of California was convicted in an on-duty shooting. He was not convicted of murder, but involuntary manslaughter. Fourthly, this is an example of state violence. And the difference between state violence and regular, what we call regular black-on-black murders, is state violence, the perpetrator almost always either gets away scot-free or is given very, very little punishment. There's very little accountability. And so, again, we see that through the lens of the Meserly case. This is one of the ways that police get away with murder.
And, in fact, Meserly only served about a year in prison.
Yes, he served a combined total of 12 months. And by combined, I don't mean from the point that he was convicted and released. Combined in terms of when the murder first happened and he was placed under arrest and then later bailed out. His time was calculated from that point to be 1 year total. And in the state of California, involuntary manslaughter is a nonviolent felony. And in California, nonviolent felonies, those persons who are convicted of such are given 1 day good credit in jail for every day that they spend. He was sentenced to 2 years in jail. For that 1 day he sat in jail, he got another day credit. He walked out after 12 months total.
And as you said, this killing was recorded on video. I'm assuming that that had something to do with you putting the words "no doubt" in the title.
That's one of the reasons why I put "no doubt" in the title. The other reason is because the prosecutor, the defense attorney, and the judge would stress to the jury that you have to have a deep and abiding faith and conviction in this person's guilt or innocence. There can be no doubt of their guilt or their innocence. Of course, there was no doubt in my mind when I first saw the video. After going through the trial, I still had no doubt. And then later on after the trial, when I began to do more research, I came across the words of Judge C. Don Clay, who conducted the preliminary hearings in Alameda County in 2009. Those preliminary hearings were conducted to see whether or not there was enough evidence to bind Johannes Meserly over for trial. And at the conclusion of those hearings, Judge C. Don Clay stated, "There's no doubt in my mind that Johannes Meserly meant to pull his gun and not his taser."
And your book is coming out in January. What kind of resources were you able to draw upon?
Well, I'm attempting to self-publish this book in the tradition of Ida B. Wells. I've got an Indiegogo campaign going right now. The address for that is igg.me/at/no doubt. Or people can go to that link from the website for the book, triplemurder.com. I'm attempting to self-publish the book in time for the fifth anniversary of Oscar Grant's murder, which was January 1st. And really, those are the only resources I have. I'm a freelance journalist. I know you know what that's like. I decided not to attempt to approach any publishing houses because I wanted the independence of my voice as a black woman and as an observer of this trial to be left intact. So I'm self-publishing the book, and I need all the help I can get.
In the hopes that folks will support their own publications.
Their own publications, make an investment in this work. This is a documenting of the trial, and it's important that we document everything. And it's easier to document now that we're living in a digital age, but also because there's still a political and aesthetic place for actual printed books. That's why I'm raising money to self-publish the book. We want to do e-books, of course, but it's nice to have an actual physical printed book as a record in the world. So www.triplemurder.com. People can view the book trailer as you saw the book trailer. They can see some of the blurbs that have been written on the book, and they can go to the Indiegogo site to make a donation.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. And while you're there, check out the latest episode of Black Agenda Television. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the black left. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Melissa Gerson.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.